So it's actually going. All right. Well, I'm Peter Wem. Most of you who are here obviously know who I am. Some don't. People on the stream recording. I work for Yahoo. I've been involved with FreeBSD for quite some time. About a month ago, I just passed my 10th anniversary on the FreeBSD core team. I realized that about 2 days after it actually happened, so it's been a while now. Back in 2001, when I started working for Yahoo, the whole Intel IA64 thing started coming online, and people started to look towards what was going to happen in the future as a replacement for i386. Basically, Yahoo being FreeBSD based, we needed to have some kind of plan about where we were going forward to make sure that we didn't get stranded with hardware that no longer ceased to be made, or like if everybody was actually going to switch to IA64, then we needed to make sure that FreeBSD worked on it. So we started looking around. We had a summit that the Intel folks came and gave a presentation on, and we got most of the key FreeBSD developer folks that could actually be there in one room and look at the architecture from top to bottom. And basically it was a high pressure full day primer on IA64. And just after that, the AMD folks basically said that, quite right there, Julian. Trying to get some more volume to the mic, to the recorder. Echo. For the benefit of the people not in the room, Julian just been crawling around in the field. And basically, the AMD folks obviously realized that part of the design of the IA64 was to make it as difficult as possible to clone. And by making it as complex as they could, they presumably figured that they could get several years of head start before anybody would be able to implement anything even remotely close to a compatible system. So they decided that they would come up with their own system. And that's where things became interesting. Right about that point, we had a couple of Yahoo employees, long-time employees, leave and went to AMD, and opportunities arose for us to get hold of developer machines sort of on the fast track, and it looked very interesting. So that was back in 2001, and here we are today. Probably just do a little bit of back history on what the CPUs are and what they do and the main features of them. So first of all, there was the Intel 8088, 8086 family. They were fairly simple, classic microprocessors. They had 8 general-purpose registers. They were 16 bits wide each. Could access 64K of memory in addressing modes. And they had this nifty little feature called segment registers, which allowed them to extend the addressing mode so they could access a whopping 1 megabyte of memory. Of course, on the IBM PCs of the day, the way that memory was divided up, you ended up with 640K of RAM and 384K of ROM and expansion area for memory cards, video card, and so on like that. That fairly quickly reached its limitations, and next generation was the 80286 family. 80186 was in between there and was used a lot in embedded applications. But 80286 was the next big revision of it. What they did with that was they added a whole series of tables. They didn't want to change any of the registers or addressing modes or anything like that, so they came up with an indirect way of getting access to more memory and larger programs. So they came up with this system called descriptor tables, and the segment registers, instead of being an address in memory where the segment lived, it was now an index into a descriptor table. So whenever you loaded a number into a segment register, it would go and do a memory lookup to find the actual address of the segment. And it was doing this continuously. Every time an instruction happened, it would do this constantly. this caused some interesting problems, amongst which were things like, if any of you remember back to the Windows, early Windows days with Windows 2.0 and OS 2 and things like that, they had things like near and far and huge and all these various addressing modes, code models, and to try and get around the basic limitation that everything had to be broken up into 64K chunks. And so that quickly became apparent that they had to do something about that. So the next, just before I go on, the tables that they used basically allowed 24 bits of addressing, so that gave 2^24, so 16 megabytes of memory. And for compatibility reasons, they kept the first megabyte of memory the same, and the extended PCIe memory came after that. Anyway, along came the 386. They basically decided that all this 286 software was fine and they didn't want to break OS 2 or anything like that. So they added on a few extra little bits into the middle of all these tables and expanded all the addresses from 24 bits to 32 bits. And the segments now, instead of being limited to 64K, could now be up to 4 gigabytes long. And things like Windows and Unix operating systems all of a sudden found the microprocessor interesting, because basically what you could do is you could set all the segments that started at a physical address 0 and all of the segments to be 4 gigabytes long, and then you could just ignore all this nightmare stuff. And so that's basically when Unix became a serious contender on the Intel CPUs. I mean, things like Xenix and so on were generally pretty small before that, but the 80386 was the dam breaker that made it really viable for everybody. Then of course you have things like the 386 BSD and the AT&T lawsuits and so on like that. That all happened in that era. The architecture of the 80386 was still fairly limited, especially by today's standards. It evolved sort of in logical steps. So they did the 486, which had the integrated floating point unit rather than an external device. Pentium had two pipelines and had limited superscalar abilities. Pentium Pro was truly superscalar. It decoded the instructions down into micro operations and could do speculative execution, execute instructions out of order, and somehow managed to keep it all untangled and make it look and work like it's supposed to. Of course, in the middle of all this, you have the AMD CPUs, which had some similarities in their design with the K7 family. And then you had the Pentium 4, which came along after that, which was basically designed to get the clock speed as high as possible for various marketing reasons. And so they basically increased the clock speed and made the amount of work done with each clock proportionally reduced. So as they increased it, it did less with each clock. So that caused some interesting problems with people like putting side by side a 2 gigahertz CPU versus a 3 gigahertz CPU and discovering that they did the same amount of work. And people started asking interesting questions. Meanwhile, they were busy working on IA64. Intel's grand plan, presumably, was to make sure that by the time they actually got this thing working, it would be such a mammoth task for anybody else to clone it that they would have maybe 5-10 years worth of head start over everybody else. And they really designed the platform to last for 20-25 years. And so they designed it with all sorts of brave assumptions, like clock speeds would be forever increasing, compiler technology would be forever improving, the compilers would be able to find more parallelism as time went by. The only problem was some of those assumptions didn't turn out to be too good. Compilers can't do that with classic code. It works great for certain specialized applications like weather simulators, nuclear weapon simulators, all sorts of things like that. There's massive numbers of independent floating point operations, but for typical C code, like a C compiler or running a desktop or anything like that, there's just not that much parallelism in the way that people write code. Compilers just can't find enough to do it. So their assumptions were that that CPU processors were going to get better, so they had a huge number of registers. So while the Intel family up until that point had 8 registers, the IA64 Yartanium family, had 128 64-bit registers and an additional 128 floating-point registers. Of course, this is quite a bit of context to save and restore if you ever do a context switch, but they figured that all this would be improved over time, so they were looking for a 5-10 year window for this stuff to really, really hit its stride and run. Part of the way that they did this was having the way that they structured it was something based on the very large instruction word concept. So the classic problem of the original 286, 386 family was each time that all of the instruction bytes were used up, they would put on extra little prefixes to say, don't do it the way that it used to do it some different way instead. So you'd have prefixes with prefixes with prefixes. They sat down and redesigned the IE64 system so that it would be have huge instructions that they couldn't think of any ways that it wasn't possible to represent things. So the 128-bit wide instructions, they broke it up into three 41-bit instructions inside each bundle. And so each instruction's actually got three sub-instructions built into it. And the compiler has to find three instructions that can execute simultaneously. Basically, with the silicon as they implemented it, it would execute two of those instruction bundles per clock, so there would be up to six instructions being able to execute per clock cycle. Because the assumption was that the compiler was going to be able to do all of this work, they didn't implement any out-of-order execution, they didn't implement any speculation, so speculations where the CPU will try it doesn't know the answer. If it doesn't know the answer to a particular calculation that hasn't been completed yet, it might, and the instruction flow depends on the results of that, it may actually try executing both alternatives, and then when it finds out which one was the correct one, it'll just cancel out all the ones that were wrong, and then complete the ones that it turned out to be doing right. So the Yartanium doesn't do any of that because, again, the assumption is that the compiler is going to do all of the work. The only problem was compilers still can't do the work. This is after working on the problem for 6, 7, 8 years now, they still haven't been able to make the chip perform with regular run-of-the-mill code that regular people write that's not written for massively parallel number crunching. And so they ended up with a chip that was 462 square millimeters, which a normal chip is about 80 or 90 square millimeters by current standards for a CPU. And so this thing is hugely expensive. I heard unofficial numbers that it cost Intel $6,500 or so to produce each Yartanium chip, and they were selling them at approximately $2,000 to $2,500 each. So again, that's not official numbers, that's just numbers that I heard somewhere, and it seems plausible. It seems plausible to me, given just the sheer size of the thing. So anyway, it was really good at floating point. It was really hit its stride on massively parallel things, so it's made its way into number crunching labs and simulations. Lawrence Livermore uses clusters of them. Again, it works really well on applications that it's suited for. It draws a bit of power. The ones that I have in my cube, I'm afraid to turn on two of them at once because they pull 5 amps of power each, and I don't know what my circuit breakers in my cube will do. I think we have 20 amps for the whole row of the cube that I'm on. And there's a vice president who lives down, who is stationed down at the end of the row, and I'm afraid that if I knock out his machine, might not go down too well. They implemented, because it still had to be backwards compatible and had to be able to run applications, they came up with an interesting system. They used a bit of spare silicon space to decode regular I386 instructions, and a whole series of software in the firmware enabled it, early versions of it, to actually boot up 32-bit operating systems. You could actually boot up previously I386 on the early Yartaniums and it would work. It would be horrendously slow, some of my tests, like doing the GSM, for example, would take 20 or so times longer to run on, so a 750 megahertz Pentium 3 versus an 800 megahertz Itanium at the time was slowed down by about a factor of 20 for doing GSM. So that was, they were in serious trouble with that. Meanwhile, AMD decided that this was a pretty big undertaking, and they would at least give it a shot at doing a 64-bit extension first. You're quite alright there, George. So anyway, they figured that it was a massive engineering undertaking to implement this, and they looked at the specs and figured that it was going to take years to design a functional implementation of it. They weren't sure that it was even possible to do economically, so they stepped back and decided, well, let's take a chance and do yet another extension to the 32-bit architecture that we has been extended 3-4 times now. So,
hang on. You might take a break for the advertisers while I restart something.
Oops, you just broken it?
No, but someone asked for a higher volume, and the stupid thing, I can't change the settings unless I stop the broadcast and restart it again.
Oh, so I can advertise?
Hmm?
I can advertise. Hang on. Iron Port's hiring. So ironport.com, we have a first page.
Huh? Yeah, no, you can't advertise without just stop the broadcast to try and change
it.
Damn it, he says!
And if you get a job at Iron Port,
do you want to pause the camcorder?
It's worth $1,000.
Word.
Julian, do you want to pause the camcorder while you get that going?
Try that.
Okay, can anybody hear this now?
Just point the mic straight at you.
Straight at me? Oh, that's much more intimidating. Eek! You can actually hear this now, can you?
Much better.
Oh, the only problem is now I can't see my notes. So anyway, are we ready yet?
Let me ask for clarification. So basically the Itanium 64-bit extension is basically independent of the old 386, which
is
functionality.
Yes, Itanium is a completely different design. They basically said, well, if we're going to design a system that's going to last for 25 years, what do we think we're going to be able to use on silicon for the next 20 to 25 years? So that we aren't going to run into architectural problems. We want Itanium to last for a long time.
Okay, so there simply isn't any compatibility between that and the 386 instruction.
It has basic compatibility in that it can execute user mode 386 instructions and can emulate operating system level instructions in firmware, in software, pretty much like what VMware does. So essentially it had something vaguely VMware-like inside the firmware, so that if you actually tried to boot off a 386 operating system, it would actually run all this stuff in firmware and would trap and emulate all of the privileged instructions.
Oh, okay, but no one would ever use it that way except if they had to execute legacy software.
Yes, it was so horrendously slow, about a factor of 20 slowdown over comparable systems, that they took that out of the firmware, and it does not appear in any of the Itanium 2 firmware that I have ever seen. So none of the Itanium 2 hardware will actually allow you to boot a pure 32-bit operating system. It can still run 32-bit code, but not the entire operating system. Yeah.
So what about the assembler programmers? Do they still get EAX and all that good stuff, or do they have to relearn?
In Itanium?
Yeah,
it's completely different. It's something truly special. So you better have a good working semicolon key, because that's how you in assembler. That's how you mark points that can be concurrently executed. So you write all of these instructions, and then you put a double semicolon which says all of these instructions may be executed simultaneously, and they don't depend on any results of each other. So you have to get all that straight in your head. It's really, really hard to do.
That's really interesting, considering that the semicolon is the comment deliverer.
Yes. The double semicolon is special.
Huh. Okay, so Itanium is basically used for some very specialized applications and almost nothing else. Is that fair?
Today, that's correct, yes.
And there's a... Okay.
The kinds of things that I imagine Itanium is really good at is would be things like weather simulations that do massive amounts of floating point. It's got a really good floating point system on it. I know it's used for nuclear weapon simulation at Lawrence Livermore Labs as well. So
I wonder how hard it would be to get Itanium to execute three streams of instructions coming from different contexts, so that you could do, like we have with nowadays with the multiple.
I think that's the kind of thing that. So you're basically asking whether they might be able to do hyper-threading three times.
Yeah.
I think they use techniques like that in the new software emulator that they're putting on the new Itanium 2s. So they're getting rid of this hardware, they realize it was a mistake, and they can actually do it better in software than they could do it in hardware. So,
thank you.
So, anyway.
So basically, FreeBSD does not run on Itanium 64-bit.
It does.
Does.
Yes, we have a madman in London by the name of Doug Rabson, and he wrote it. He put something together that based solely on the manuals, and later he got it booting on the simulator when it came out, and it runs on real hardware. And I think the sum total of FreeBSD IA64 users is one, maybe two.
Marcel,
and I think there's a guy at one of the Intel labs that actually has a FreeBSD box running on Itanium that he boots up every now and then. So I think that's the entire total of the IA64 FreeBSD users.
So the system itself runs in 64-bit mode?
Yes, pure 64-bit mode, and on the current hardware we run 32-bit applications on it as well. And that's basically, each process sees a full 4 gigabytes of address space and can do anything it likes, because it's all emulated.
Okay, but then AMD went ahead and they did a straightforward extension.
Yep.
He's coming to that.
I'm getting there, yep.
that's what I'm asking.
Yep. So anyway, what AMD did was they sat down and they thought, well, we don't want to end up in the situation where we've added all this extra complexity onto the instruction stream, which is the reason why Intel was tempted to leave the x86 area to start with. So they thought, well, if we sit down and we get out the big carving knife and we remove as much of this cruft that's been there for backwards compatibility as possible and keep it all off to one side, then we can theoretically make 64-bit code run really, really, really fast. And that's what they did. So they got rid of all of the segment registers, the descriptor tables. So in 32-bit code, every time you look at segment registers, it accesses memory to look up the descriptor tables or the caches of the descriptor tables. That's gone. So now when you generate an address, you just generate an address. That's it. There's no translation or segments or anything getting in the way. The interrupts are all 64-bit, so it basically means that the kernel has to run in 64-bit mode if you're going to support 64-bit applications. So unlike PowerPC, for example, where you can have a 32-bit kernel with 64-bit applications like Apple use, on AMD 64 architecture, you can't do that. If you want to run 64-bit applications of any sort, then you have to have a pure 64-bit kernel. Amongst the other things that they changed, the 8 general purpose registers, there's now 16 of them. The 32-bit registers are now 64 bits wide, so there's now 4 times as much context to load and save. The 8 old-style floating point registers and MMX registers are the same. They're still 80 bits and there's no change there. They double the number of SSE registers, so there used to be 8 128-bit registers, now there's 16 128-bit registers. That all fits in the FX save, FX restore buffer, so again there's more context there, but it's transparent to the operating system. Things like the external floating point unit's gone, so you know that you have a floating point unit. They eliminated a whole series of 1-byte instructions to collapse. So they reclaimed 16 1-byte instructions in order to collapse the prefix tree down considerably. So that for many, many instructions that may have taken one or one, two, maybe even three prefixes, you can now do it with one prefix. So you use a prefix to specify the upper half of the registers, so the upper eight registers instead of the lower eight registers, or if you're doing a 64-bit instruction instead of a 32-bit instruction, you use a prefix to specify that. But for the most part, it executes pretty much just like a simplified 32-bit model. Then there's a special secret mode that exists only on one website that I happened to come across early in the piece. Apparently there's some special mode that you can actually trick the CPU into running 64-bit applications on a 32-bit kernel. I don't remember the website that I saw that on. I think it was something like sandpile.org or something. They discovered this in the Microsoft assembler. It recognized certain instructions, and there was a piece of information leaked somewhere. And basically what they did was they managed to put all the extra registers in the floating point area. And so in theory, you could use a 64-bit device driver, for example, think of a graphics card driver, and save and restore context with that and make your graphics drivers go faster on an AMD CPU, even without the knowledge of the operating system. So they also did various other optimizations. The page table tree is in cached memory. They hook bus snoop operations onto the cache lines that the page table tree lives in. So if you reload the page table pointers and you haven't actually changed the page table pages, it gets optimized out to a no-op. So if you do a context switch from one kernel thread to another, it doesn't actually do anything because they're the same page table tree and you haven't actually modified anything.
Theoretically, we don't do that in previous D anyhow, right?
Except somebody pointed out that there's a bug in that today, so... Apparently, every kernel thread currently has its own page directory page at the moment, so apparently that optimization is absolutely useless on FreeBSD at the moment in 32-bit mode. So there's various other things that they changed. The calling conventions are quite different. For 32-bit code, typically what happens is you push all of the arguments onto the stack, and then you begin executing the function or the subroutine, which reads all the arguments off the stack and does whatever it pleases, puts them into the scarce registers that it has available. For 64-bit applications, they realized that these memory operations were slowing things down, so they sped things up by having functions put all the arguments into registers. And so it's pure register passing calling convention. That works really, really well unless you start trying to do a stack trace, because now there's nothing interesting on the stack. So when you have an application that gives you a core dump, it's very, very difficult to find what the arguments to a given function were, because they may not exist anymore. At that point in the program, they may be completely gone. It may have been a temporary register that is not kept anywhere else and is available for use by the function, and it's been reused, so there's no copies anymore.
So there's no load and store? Back in.
Correct, yes.
No more of that?
No more of that.
Oh, that sucks. I don't have to debug dumps anymore.
Yeah, well, it caused quite a bit of head scratching when people had that very same reaction. Okay, how do we diagnose a stack trace or a crash dump? People like Oracle were very unhappy about this. So how do you do an automatic analysis? It's very difficult. Some of them were, yes. Things like Spark, for example, use register windows, and so they rotate the register window, and so you can always see what was there. But with the register calling conventions in AMD 64 native assembler, it's not given that it's going to be available. Now, what they have done since then is put enhanced the Dwarf 2 debug spec. And taught GCC how to produce far more descriptive dwarf. And so basically what happens is GDB can look at the debug info, and it can say, all right, at this particular point, the argument we know is actually stored over in the debug info. So it will stash a copy of it simply because there's no other place for it, solely for debugging. Yeah.
So if a function takes four arguments and then it calls some other function that takes four arguments, then the function returns. Did the first function lose its arguments, or where did they go?
It better save them if it wants to use them. Now, that's the other interesting quirk. All but two of the registers that are reserved for function call arguments are scratch registers. So you put the arguments into registers and make a call, and that function that you call is free to trash them whenever it's ready. And so if the function that was making the call wants to keep them, the caller has to save the registers. Because the assumption is that if you make a call, any of your scratch registers will be trashed, and that just happens to include most of your arguments. Yes?
But doesn't the C compiler have to save this for it automatically then?
The compiler does it automatically.
Does it automatically?
Yes. Okay. And it does a pretty good job of it, actually. It works really well.
What if you use the caller saves compiler option?
You're already using that, essentially.
Oh, okay, so it's basically redundant at that point?
You're basically operating in register parameters, caller saves, and a few other weird options. It's not RTD, return caller deallocates, no. So if you push things on the stack, then the caller is the one who removes them. There's another interesting quirk. All of the registers, because arguments now pass in registers, that makes things like vararg's really interesting. On 32-bit applications, you can walk through the argument list by just pointing to things on the stack and stepping through as you go. On AMD64 binaries, the compiler generates a descriptor structure that says the first six arguments are here, and then the next few arguments are on the stack, and then there's a few arguments in floating point registers, and then there's a few arguments in the SSE registers, and the VA start and VA next and VA arg macros have a really interesting time picking all of that out. Fortunately, the compiler takes care of all of that, but if you look at the code that it's doing, it's really scary. So that's one complication. Another interesting thing that they do is there's a red zone on the stack. So typically when in 32-bit code, what you would do is you would push arguments onto the stack, which lower the stack pointer down. You're constantly doing operations that move the stack. If your function does not make any other function calls, right, there's a special 128-byte region reserved below the stack pointer. What are you looking at, Julian?
There was paper to lift.
Oh, okay. It's a special 128-byte region that's reserved as scratch space for the current function. If you make another function call, then obviously then it's free to trash it. But what that means is if you need memory quickly for storing something, you don't need to do stack pointer operations. It's just there and you just use it, even though it's below the stack pointer. That makes interesting things for signal handlers because they now have to preserve this 128-byte space. Otherwise, if you have a signal in the middle of bad things happen.
is this in hardware or is this just calling convention?
This is calling convention. It can work either way. You can do plain x86 style calling conventions. It's no major difficulty either way. It just works faster. And that's, with those kinds of things, they're able to get the cost of all of the extra context and context switches and the extra context overheads are somewhat offset by the various speed-ups and the calling conventions. So if you take a 32-bit operating system and application code with less context and doing less memory operations and smaller pointers, it works out around about on par or a little bit faster in 64-bit mode. So you win something from the calling convention, you lose something from the larger context and larger pointers, and some things it hurts, most things it slightly helps, and some things it helps a lot. So
what do you disable the red zone in the kernel?
In the kernel, we disable the red zone because we don't have much stack. We only have 8K of stack, and taking 128 bytes is just too much of a chunk. And basically because I took the easy way out at the time. Actually, no, now that I think about it, there was actually another reason for it. It's because the hardware trap handlers don't respect any red zone concept. So if you're expecting to sort of have hardware trap things go on there, then you can't depend on that being preserved. But yeah, it's several reasons. It's just basically, the main one is because there's just not enough stack space to, I haven't actually tried it. It may not actually be that hard to implement, but it just didn't seem worth the hassle at the time. So, one of the other changes they made is floating point arguments are now passed in SSE red style registers rather than in the x87 stack registers. That speeds things up considerably. In 32-bit mode, when you do floating point arguments, even on a system that has SSE registers, basically the i386 calling convention is put the floating point numbers in the 80387 register stack, make the function call. The target function then takes them out of the register stack, puts them into SSE registers, does SSE operations, and then puts the result code back onto the x87 FP register stack, and then returns. So it uses SSE totally transparently, but the calling convention is to use x87 instructions still. In 64-bit mode, it uses SSE2 permanently, and that's all that it does. E3, of course, uses the floating point style ones as well, but there's no real need for them. Okay, on i386 they have two-level page tables, and basically they have 4 bytes each, 1024 entries, and that basically maps 4 gigabytes of virtual address, and 4-byte entries give 32-bit physical addresses. So in native mode it allows 4 gigabyte processors and kernels to live in the same space, and gives you 34 gigabytes of physical memory. With the Pentium Pro, they added an extension to that, so they doubled the physical addresses. So there's now 512 entries each, which meant that they had to do a small third layer. So this is the so-called PAE mode. So basically, it gives you the same virtual address space, but you can now have more physical memory. It doesn't help much if you're running out of malloc room or mmap room, but if you're trying to cache stuff, it's useful. AMD 64, rather than do what Intel did with the hash style page tables, added another layer on top of that. So now they have 4 levels. So you have page table pages, you have the page directory pages, you have the page directory page tables, and you now have another layer on top of that, which is the page map level 4 table. And that basically gives 256 terabytes of virtual address space, 48 bits of virtual address space, and it uses the PAE style 8-byte entries. Because it's 64-bit addresses, they had to figure out how to map the page table space onto for actual users, and so they divided it in half and gave half to the kernel and half to the user, so users only get as measly little 128 terabytes, and the kernel only gets 128 terabytes for itself as well. So that was one of the interesting things when first started the FreeBSD port, is what to do with all this stuff. Obviously, we want to give the users as much memory as we can, but how to make best use of this with the kernel was the interesting thing. So what I ended up doing was, like on i386, which has a section of 4K pages that it can map physical memory to and from on demand. So if it needs to access a disk buffer, it'll map it into the kernel. And do various operations on it, and then unmap it when it's finished. The AMD 64 FreeBSD kernel has the same mapping area, and for various inconvenient reasons, it's limited to 2 megabytes. 2 gigabytes, I'm sorry, that's a little better. So there's 2 gigabytes of KVA, or kernel virtual address space. I took another 512 gigabytes of space and just simply just did a one-to-one mapping for all of physical memory in the machine and all of the hardware devices, so that the kernel can access anywhere in memory that it wants to without having to do any temporary mappings anymore. So things like the SFBuf allocate and deallocate that makes send file go faster, and all the various bounce buffers that use that. We don't. It's all in NOAP on AMD64 because it just looks up the corresponding physical address in the direct map region and accesses it directly from there. And then there's the recursive page table map, and that's all I've been able to figure out what to use. And of course, I've got about 127.5 terabytes left, and I haven't. I don't foresee running out of kernel address space. And 128 terabytes ought to be enough for anybody. Of course, yeah, just stepping back for a little bit, IO64 happens to give 4,096 petabytes of virtual address space, but so what? problems we've run into. With those wretched indirect tables I was talking about, the LDT and GDT, most of those are gone and are no longer used. As a last minute oops, they discovered that was actually rather convenient for things like thread local storage. And so right at the last minute, they decided that they would add back an instruction that would allow you to do non-zero addressing for the FS and GS registers. So for that, just for the FS and GS segment registers, they have the ability to point to anywhere in the 64-bit address space. The second oops, they made them privileged. And so the user processors that would most like to use them can't actually use them. Only the kernel can do it. So instead of being able to do a nice simple instruction to change from one thread to another, you now need to make a syscall, or you have your thread library do an indirection layer for you. It was a series of oops. Things like 32-bit applications that use segment registers, Wine being one, the initial implementation of thread local storage in i386 also uses the segment registers. That makes it kind of hard to emulate those in the 32-bit layer because the kernel infrastructure is just not there. There's a few other minor things, like they forgot to implement a compare and exchange for 16-byte instructions, so you can't do lock lists, linked lists, insertions and operations. Intel incidentally fixed that. So the Intel 64-bit CPUs now have that, and AMD have picked it up. Other problems. Originally it was called x86-64, then Microsoft said, we aren't typing minus signs into the platform names, and we're not going to use an underscore either. And so Microsoft made AMD change it to AMD64, which AMD figured was kind of self-grandiose, but went along with it anyway. And lo and behold, Linux folks had already done a good portion of the work and decided that they weren't going to change. So we ended up with AMD64, and Linux ended up with x86-64. And of course, all of the free software out there seems to be well and truly split between the two camps. So Windows' internal architecture name is still AMD64. Linux kernel uses x86-64. GCC uses x86-64. GDB and binutils use AMD64, and there's just general chaos everywhere. And then, of course, Microsoft, when Intel decided to gave in and implemented this, obviously AMD64 was somewhat unpalatable for them, for calling their CPUs by. So they managed to convince Microsoft right at the last minute to change to x64, so we have yet another variation on it. And nobody really seems to know what the thing is supposed to be called. And so all of the config scripts generally accept all of the variations, and that makes for some very interesting config scripts. Some various other problems have turned up. The 64-bit instruction stream is not actually native 64-bit entirely. if you've ever done assembly programming, you generally have instructions with immediate values embedded in the data stream. So if you want to load, put an arbitrary value into a register, you store the value in an immediate in the data stream. Well, those are only 32 bits still. So if you want to put 64 bits into a register, you have to use a couple of special instructions. But the really good part is these special instructions only work on the EAX or RAX register. And so if you want to load an arbitrary 64-bit value into a register, you have to do everything detoured via the RAX or EAX register. For the most part, that's not too much of a problem. When you're using shared libraries, the interface layer between all the shared libraries is a jump table. And so as long as your actual shared libraries don't go larger than 2 gigabytes, then everything is within reach of plus or minus 31 bits of immediate addressing. And so the global offset table contains all pointers to all of the external objects that you might want to reference. The jump tables all contain pointers through 64-bit entries. For the most part, it's generally not a problem. The time that it does turn into a problem is when you take non-PIC compiled code and try and link it into a shared library. There's a relocation type that you would need that just simply doesn't exist. And so we have this problem with FreeBSD ports a lot. I don't remember the actual the error message, but it's the one that tells you to recompile it with minus fpic, which causes some very interesting workarounds, none of which are particularly good. The real solution, of course, is to actually compile the objects in PIC mode and the non-PIC ones in non-PIC still, but many people just compile everything, including the application, with PIC and just hope the problem goes away. And it does, it just makes things a little slower.
Wasn't there something about the L64 specification that only required any PIC anyway?
Don't know.
That's from the E5 stuff, I remember running across them about telephone stuff needs to be PIC. Maybe it's only for stuff that has to be shared.
There's some really weird relocation types that we don't implement. And frankly, I'm surprised we haven't run into them. I think I've implemented about 6 out of 24 or 25, and none of our tool chain generates them, at least not that I've seen yet. What the actual spec requires, I don't know. One that says relocation would be truncated or something like that. It mentions x86_32, I think it is.
Or x86-64-32-S.
Yes, that one.
Yeah.
And that's basically because the relocation table says stuff this 64-bit value truncated down to 32 bits in this particular 32-bit offset. And of course, in a shared library environment, you can't guarantee that the 64-bit address is going to be within the first 2 gigabytes of memory. And that's the problem, you can't guarantee that. That's the mode that we compile the kernel in. That's why that very same problem is the reason why the kernel address space is 2 gigabytes. Anyway, just moving on a little bit before we run out of tape.
I've got 2 tapes.
You got 2 tapes, okay. Damn. So what was Intel doing while all of this was going on? Actually, no. I'm just trying to figure out what I can and can't say, because I knew some things under NDA and I knew some things under pre-NDA. I knew things that people were told. If you tell people, you will no longer be working at Intel. So, yeah. But needless to say, Intel had the very first Prescott cores had fully functional 64-bit. Had AMD 64 compatible 64-bit stuff. Every single one of them from Prescott onwards. When they shrank the die from 130 nanometers to 90 nanometers, part of the reason why the power consumption went up and why why the pipelines were increased was just simply to make room for 64-bit mode. And it was a hedging of bets. They weren't sure whether they were going to be able to make the IE64 stuff fly, whether AMD 64 was going to take off, and they needed a plan B if they needed to sort of pull out their stops and go, whoops, we're just kidding with this IE64 stuff. Which it turned out that they had to do. So anyway, they first of all called their version of it IA32E, and the very first working silicon that they released booted FreeBSD AMD64 after one minor bug fix, which was my own fault. So the very first silicon, you could say, was pretty damn close to AMD64 compatible. They've since changed it to, renamed it all to EM64T, so it's sort of implying that it's all about extra memory now rather than 64-bitness, but anyway. Unlike Linux, as I said, unlike Linux, FreeBSD actually booted first go, and it's a bit of a sad story about that. The reason why we booted first go was because AMD never gave me all of the documentation to use all of the cool features that they had on their silicon. So I didn't know how to use the Northbridge, the input IOMMU stuff. I didn't use any of the 3D Now instructions and various other things that Intel didn't implement. I didn't use any of the magic chipset support because I didn't have the chipset documentation. So the FreeBSD AMD64 port is essentially using a 64-bit CPU inside 32-bit hardware infrastructure. So it doesn't use anything that existed. It never used anything that existed only on Opterons or Athlon 64s, simply because I just didn't have ready access to the documentation for it. For example, they had the event timers. We may have used that instead of the clock. IOMMU I've mentioned. I still don't know how to use the IOMMU. David O'Brien.
Wow.
At which point he's probably telling me, at which point David's probably saying, yes, but I told you it's all on the website, which I
never did.
Which I never, ever, ever had a password for. He keeps telling me to get it off the NDA website, which I never had a password for, and there's data sheets around that have been pointed out to me after the fact, but at the time I didn't know that they were there. So after we were booting on the Intel hardware was the first time I found that these things actually existed in a freely downloadable form. So it was a bit late then. I'm sorry, David. Anyway, enough of that for the moment. Running 32-bit applications. One interesting thing about this CPU is that it is a 32-bit CPU with 64-bit extensions. So it runs 32-bit applications exactly the same as it would if it was running a 32-bit operating system. The instruction decoder is the same, the registers are the same. Everything runs the same except obviously you have a different kernel present.
Someone mentioned that it was in a disused laboratory with a sign on the door saying, beware of the leopard.
Okay.
The password.
That was a secret password, was it? I see. Okay. Anyway, 32-bit applications. So basically, we were able to reuse much of the 32-bit application emulation layer code that was done for the IA64, because they both supported hardware execution of 32-bit instructions. And basically we implemented a system call layer, pretty much like we do with Linux compatibility drivers. It takes the arguments, converts the ones that have to be converted, and relays the calls across the native 64-bit system calls. So things that have to be done include things that have timestamps. So we have 64-bit timestamps now instead of 32-bit timestamps. Any data structure that has a pointer in it has to be converted. So if you do a stat system call and it passes a pointer, that actually doesn't have to be converted. What is going on over there? You're out of tape?
Not yet,
okay. Many of the system calls didn't actually have to be converted, even though they took 64-bit arguments, like stat, for example, simply because we zero-extend all of the arguments. And it just happens to fit in the bottom 32 bits of user address space and just happens to work. pointers inside structures are a big problem. The contents of the stat are different because they have timestamps. I should be able to think of a whole pile of them, but it's basically timestamps, pointers, offsets. Oh, that's the other good one. FreeBSD 32 bits always supported 64-bit file offsets, but because it's always passed them as two 32-bit arguments, they only ever had 32-bit alignment requirements. And the moment that your off-T changes from 64-bit with 32-bit alignment into a full 64-bit object, you now have to convert all the data structures because the alignment's different. That's where most of the system call conversion comes from. One of the things that I didn't do was I didn't actually do any path name translation. So Linux, for example, sticks everything under compat Linux. And every time you do an open syscall or a rename or a link or an unlink or anything that references a path, it does two file system lookups. One to see if it exists in the compatibility layer and one to see if it's on the native operating system. And the reason for that is Linux has different file formats in the slash etc. directory, for example. So it uses etc. password and shadow, whereas we use master.password and put everything in .db files. So holes, their l.so.conf is different. There's a whole series of things that I don't remember the details for. But that was the main reason why that existed. Then you have shared libraries with the same names, and I figured that there had to be another way to do this. So what I did was I gave it a try with running 64-bit applications and verified that all of the binary files in the etc. directory are interchangeable. So etc. pwd.db, for example, can be read and written the same way by both 32-bit and 64-bit applications. So there wasn't actually any need to have two different sets of configuration files because they're all the same. The notable exceptions were anything to do with shared libraries, things like libmap.conf and the lv.so configuration files. So what I did with that was change the exec layer to translate the lv.so path at startup time and have a specially compiled version of lv.so that knew all of the alternate locations for the files that it needed that had to be different. So ld32.elf.so.1 knows that it's got to look at libmap32.conf, and it looks in /user/lib32 and so on. And by doing that, we're able to keep the shared libraries out of the way and have separate search paths for shared libraries for 32-bit versus 64-bit applications. And for the most part, it works. The one major thing that I haven't followed through on is I haven't sat down and figured out how to make the package add tools translate the lib to lib32 when you install a 32-bit port package. That'd be really nice, but it's theoretically possible because we do stuff like that at work. So that stuff, for the most part, just basically makes it work, and with a little care and effort, it's possible to do it. There's no automatic way of installing a 32-bit package alongside a 64-bit package. I've always done that by hand, and I'd sort of really like somebody else to figure out how to make that work at some point. Usability. Obviously, this has been going on for a while. How's it work? Well, I've been eating my own dog food since late 2002, early 2003, I think. So my primary desktop's been running this since 2003, both at work and at home. So that's running X Windows everything. Not 100% sure about the exact time frame, but it's around about then.
How much of that is 32-bit? How much of that is 64-bit?
None. None. It's pure 64-bit. I don't have any. Almost. I have a 32-bit Perforce binary, and that's the only thing that I actually use. That's 32-bit. That's the one and only thing. I don't even have a 32-bit CV sub because I still have nightmares about building a 64-bit version. But so yeah, it's with a little bit of effort, you can take a 32-bit package and make it install and run. And I've done that in the past by just extracting the tar file and renaming the lib directory to lib32 and retiring it up again, and then package add will work. Things that need to be done still.
Excuse me, we'll take a small advertisement break here. But you can come in and say that iron port's hiring. Okay, that's your ad. Now I'm going to change the tape, so hang on a sec. We'll be back in a second. Okay.
All right. So we're still here. Okay, anybody here on the cast?
Yeah. Someone says yes.
All right. Okay. So what was the question? Why bother to run 32-bit applications on a 64-bit kernel? Yep. At work on our 32-bit systems, which are running on FreeBSD 4.x still. Basically, for various tuning reasons, we increase a lot of buffers, the socket buffers, mbuffs, PV entries increase significantly, and we generally run out of the standard 1 gigabyte virtual memory address space. So by default, we have to increase our KVM from 1 gigabyte to 1.5 gigabytes at 32 bits. That leaves 2.5 gigabytes for user applications, of which generally what happens is 0.5 gigabyte is reserved for malloc, then at the other end you have space taken out for the stack, which basically means that you can't do an mmap of a file that's larger than about 1.9 gigs or so. And we have folks who would like to be able to mmap as much as humanly possible to avoid having to split load across processors and do additional hashing and things like that. So if you take that exact same binary that has the 1.9 gigabyte mmap limitation that we have at work, and you run it on a 64-bit AMD64 kernel, all of a sudden it has 3.5 gigabytes of mmap space, because the user process gets all 4 gigabytes to itself now. It doesn't have to share with the kernel. So even 32-bit applications immediately see a benefit without having to do any recompiles. Again, it assumes that if you're doing things like large mmaps or large mallocs or something like that, then you get an immediate benefit for that. And that's why we're doing it. Besides hardware support, that is. We do a lot of maintenance and backporting of drivers at work to get 4.x running on some of the newer hardware, and it's increasingly getting harder and harder, so we have to go forwards. And if we have a choice between 32-bit or 64-bit, then we may as well use the 64-bit stuff. We have some of our applications that have been recompiled and are actually running 64-bit native, but for the most part, we're just trying to take it one step at a time and running the existing 32-bit packages in 64-bit mode. Anyway, things are still to do to finish off the port. Something needs to be done to make it less painful to get a 32-bit package onto a system, so that if you have a 32-bit app, it would be really nice to be able to install a 32-bit binary package with package add or something and have it just work and not have to do all of the hand-holding and manual tweaking to get it to work. That would be really nice. I just haven't had the stomach to sit down and try and do that. There's still holes in the syscall emulation layer. In particular, things like ARCDALs and syscontrols, for example. That's a continuous source of problems because there's one syscontrol layer, and it has a difference of opinion about how large a long is. And so it wants to copy out 64 bits of data into 32-bit applications that only allow 32 bits of space. We have a few hacks in there to try and contain the damage, but the general result of that is, rather than things getting corrupted, they just simply don't work. And there's a few hacks and a few important syscontrol implementations.
control should all be ASCII.
Yeah, well, there's a really useful one like where the stack is, and
0xabcde.
Well, the pthread libraries kind of wanted to know that, and so that was one that we had to mercilessly hack to make it work. Another thing that really needs to be done is we need to implement something for local descriptor tables still. While it's not useful for 64-bit binaries, it is very useful for 32-bit binaries still. Things like Wine, for example. We can't run Wine or anything like that, or MPlayer or anything that emulates Windows-style segmentation until we provide some means for the user to provide arbitrary segments. Fixing that would basically mean that we can run 5.x i386 static binaries. We can't do that at the moment because the libc for the thread local storage makes segmentation calls into the kernel. We get around that by running binaries from 5x, the dynamic binaries, because we provide a special libc. And what it does is the 32-bit libc actually makes 64-bit AMD64 syscalls to set up all of the thread local storage stuff in such a way that it doesn't upset the 32-bit binaries. And for the most part, that's transparent, but it does not work with static binaries. And implementing the LDT syscalls would make that work. Another big thing that really needs a lot of work is libc and the math libraries are just not optimized at all. There's a few places that have been optimized, but a good portion of the math libraries were just basically me sitting down and looking at the assembler output and trying to make the existing code work. So quite often what happens is the math libraries take an SSE register, convert it back into an x87 style register on the stack, then call the old stack-based floating point instruction and convert it back to an SSE register again.
Jason Evans has a question, which is, does TLS work with static binaries at all?
Yes.
There you go, Jason.
Yes. 6.0 static binaries do work because I added a syscall i386 set FSBase to the sysarch syscall, and that's implemented in the AMD64 layer. But 5.x doesn't use that, it uses the set user LDT stuff. Let's see, what else have I got written down here? There's still a lot of ports that have i386 assembler code compiled in, and written in, and only does things if you actually compile it on a 386. A lot of hand-optimized code that really needs to be converted. It's particularly apparent in things that do compression, codecs, various high-speed sort of math functions. So if you take a port and run one thing side by side versus another, you quite often, when you see spectacular differences in speed, it's often traced back to, if you're running this on an i386, it's got a piece of assembler code that's 10 times faster than the C code, and the AMD64 code is running the slow C code, simply because there's no AMD64 assembler version of the code there. There's various infrastructure optimizations that still need to be done. There's more work that can be done on context switches. I've already mentioned things like segmentation. Now that Intel CPUs run this as well, they don't have some of the hardware optimizations that the Opterons have that I'd been assuming were existing. The TLB flush filter, for example. It was written with the assumption it would be there, and so we don't have the lazy TLB shoot down code on the AMD 64 tree. That would really be really helpful for certain specialized situations on the Intel CPUs. It makes no difference to the Athlon 64 and Opteron stuff. There's a few other problems. The Universal Memory Allocator, UMA, uses direct map pages to implement all of its stuff to avoid doing temporary mappings. So if you do malloc within the kernel, the pages actually come from the large direct map region. The only problem with that is that's implemented with 2 megabyte pages, and the Athlon 64 and Opteron only have 8 TLB entries for caching these pages. So what that means is if you access several pages in quick succession, you have TLB misses, which means you have to walk those 4 levels of page table trees, and that actually hurts performance in a number of cases. Alan Cox has been telling me a number of times that we really need to do something about that. Intel, on the other hand, have a shared TLB, so they have 500 or 1,000 or so TLB entries that can cache both 4K and 2 meg and 4 meg pages. Is there an issue with aliasing? No, there's not. At least not that I know of. The level 2 cache is physically tagged, so it doesn't matter how you get there by the TLB. You can use any TLB with any number of aliases. There's a number of cases that it's more efficient to avoid alias addresses, but I honestly am not aware of what the criteria are for when to use it and when not to. The upshot is no.
Of course, the machine check on a G5.
Yes, and the UltraSpark folks have trouble with that too. So,
back up to the TLB threshold for a second.
So yep.
There's an errata that was sending on the pop run that says there has to be table missing. Do we actually still run that or not?
That would depend on the BIOS, because as I said, we don't have any machine specific knowledge in the kernel, so we don't do any workarounds for any of the errata whatsoever.
That's a bit of a question, reminding me, it's very early errata, BRev processor issues. It's probably not something that we would ever see unless it was on.
Yeah, well, I have BRev CPUs, so.
So,
but none of them are SMP. Now I have there's other rumors that there's more modifications coming up to the page table table structure in the future, but I don't have any details about that. I heard rumors about 1 gigabyte pages, but I don't know any specifics. So that would be really, really, really nice for our direct map stuff. So if that ever sees the light of day, then that will be the first thing that will be converted, because that will just reduce the number of TLB entries required. I don't even know if that's Intel or AMD that are talking about that, so I don't know. It's a rumor. It may never see the light of day. And that's about it, so going to have to ask questions. Yep.
Do you have any plans to take advantage of specific features in the different architectures for performance or anything like that?
Good question. The IOMMU would probably be nice. David explained to me that it's basically the AGP GUT that you can use to do. Sorry, David O'Brien explained to me that it's basically another way of using the AGP GUT to do remapping, so that you can have 32-bit PCI cards access memory above the 4 gigabyte mark. Would basically require a kernel code and a driver to manage the AGP mappings. We probably have some of the infrastructure there already, but it's not something I've been looking at.
Do you know
if there's
something that's being programmed?
Is that
chipset specific programming or is there
standard API? Yes, it's chipset specific. So, for example, doing IOMMU code would require that you have specific knowledge of the Athlon 64 and Opteron memory controller in Northbridge that's on the actual CPU itself.
Yeah, it's not like Spark, but NMD is a bit more centralized.
Yeah,
it's basically
a poor man's page table system that sits in front of the memory controller so that the AGP system can get to it. And it just so happens that everything goes through it, all the I/O cycles go through it, so it works for PCI as well. I've briefly glanced at what Linux does with it, and they have about 30,000 ifdefs over their code, so I could probably sit down and figure out what they actually do with it. I mean, their Gart driver has, looks like it was intended to be used for a video card, and it looks like it has a special mode where you can optionally use it for I/O processing as well. But without actually seeing what you're supposed to do with it, you can see the code, but it's not the same as seeing what the intent of how you're supposed to use it. That was the nice thing about the AMD manuals. They said, all right, to do this, you want to do this, then this, then this, and this, and here's why. And you can't get that information from data sheets without the reference material or from Linux code. You could re-implement the Linux code in FreeBSD without too much trouble, but it's a black box.
Okay. You know, I have some meta questions.
Yep.
Which is more along the lines of, what is your opinion of the AMD 64 port of FreeBSD? Is it ready for prime time?
With caution, yes.
Okay, so Iron Port shouldn't move to it quite yet.
I'm going to carefully answer this one. What I would be saying is that you should be looking at it. You should be experimenting with it. You should be trying your stuff out on it. And if it were, if I don't think you'll run into any trouble.
Unless you have 16 gigs of RAM and SATA drives.
That's not my problem, that's Soren's problem. you're still at the mercy of bugs in the generic FreeBSD system. So if you have 16 gig SATA drives in an i386 system, you'll have the same problem. You still have balance buffer problems on i386, you run out of KVM on i386, you're still going to have trouble.
How many lines of code have been contributed for the AMD 64 effort at the right now?
That's a tough question. Actual lines that were written specifically for this, surprisingly, depressingly few considering how much work went into it. A good portion of it was basically done as a derivative of the i386 and the alpha port. The most effort for doing the port by far was the PMAP module, and basically what happened with that was I took the i386 PMAP module and adapted the general strategies that the alpha used for their three-level page tables and extended it to do four levels. There's a lot of low-level assembler work. But one of the nice things is it's actually relatively small amounts of machine-dependent code compared to i386. I'm going to guess the machine-dependent directory is probably between 1/4 and 1/3 of the size of i386. Various reasons for that. One of the things that you can't do in 64-bit mode is you can't do VM86 calls because the segmentation system is gone. You can only do application mode 32-bit and 16-bit code, but you can't do 64-bit. So that means no BIOS calls. So all the BIOS call code is gone. All the VM86 call code is gone. All of the things like the VESA video drivers are gone. The console stuff is much simpler because it doesn't have to deal with BIOS calls. There's a whole mess of things. All the PC98 ifdefs no longer exist in the AMD 64 tree. There's a lot of detection that doesn't have to be done anymore. Like the NPX code is now unconditional, is inlined, and most of the the detection code is now hardwired in. So because all systems have a floating point unit, that's all that there is. It's not even a floating point unit, it's integral to the CPU. So we treat it as such now. I really couldn't guess. I really couldn't guess how many lines of code I actually wrote for it. But as I said, it's if you actually look at it, it's depressingly small. Most of the changes were adapting and converting and adjusting and just dealing with things like red zones on stack and page tables and user line infrastructure, things like that. The bulk of the work was done from if you exclude compiler, which David O'Brien did most of the work on, if you exclude the compiler, the bulk of the actual bring up work happened in 3 weeks. So it went from there to running and self-hosting and compiling and installing completely functional in 2.5 weeks. And that was cheating though, I was only using 1 gigabyte of address space. So it made things very much, that was the thing that caused everything to click into place, because Jake Burkholder had done the PAE work. And when I was looking over the changes that he made for it, I suddenly realized that I didn't have to do the 3-level and 4-level page table trees. So I could actually concentrate on getting the core of the system up and running and then extend the address space afterwards. And so that's what I did. So made things a lot simpler, and just work on one problem at a time and training. And actually getting the machine booting meant that the page table, the PMAP stuff, could be done afterwards, incrementally, rather than as an all or nothing kind of thing, where you boot the machine and wonder why nothing happened. There's a lot of that.
Can you give some impression of what the file systems is around in terms of CPUs and memory?
Great question.
What are the largest systems that it's been run on? I think David O'Brien's probably got the biggest machine that it's ever booted. I believe it's booted on a 16 CPU system, and I don't know how much memory it had. I actually heard whispers of what the Intel folks were running FreeBSD/AMD64 on, but I'm not sure whether I'm supposed to talk about that or not.
What kind of box has 16 CPUs?
What
box has 16 CPUs?
Well, when you start talking, it's not so much how many CPUs, but how many cores.
Oh, okay.
So if you could imagine a 4-core or an 8-core CPU in a machine with 4 sockets, then that suddenly means lots of CPUs.
He says there's 3 CPUs around, and he's taking donations from power to run it.
He's what?
He's taking donations from power to run it.
I still didn't catch that.
He needs money to operate the machine.
Oh, I see.
So interesting.
Yeah.
So it's an 8 CPU with 32 gigs of RAM.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm surprised that we haven't run into memory sizing issues on that configuration, on a machine with 8 CPUs and 32 gigs of RAM. So. That's one of the problems that we have for the kernel configures itself at startup based on how much physical memory it has, and so it assumes that the more memory you have, the more likely you are to be doing various memory consuming operations, and so we size tables accordingly. The only problem was is all of those algorithms were designed when machines had 8 megs or 16 megs or 32 megs of RAM and eventually 64 megs of RAM. And the assumption was that KVM was not going to be the limiting factor for running this stuff. It was going to be physical memory would be the limits. And so when you start putting 4 gigs or 8 gigs or 16 gigs or 32 gigs of RAM in here, these tables can easily be auto-sized to consume all of the kernel virtual memory and cause the machine to very ungracefully not work. And that's the current limitations that we run into, which is simply because we don't have upper limits on auto-sizing of tables. And again, the AMD64 kernel has a disproportionately small address space for storing this stuff. So as I said, it's only got 2 gigabytes available, whereas the i386 has got 1 gigabyte by default. It's something that needs to be fixed. It's the I compile it in
a lot of places to do linkage between modules and the kernel. But that shouldn't affect just
data. The code model is basically done that way so that kernel modules can be compiled and linked in all within the same plus or minus 2 gigabytes of address space. But I didn't want to construct jump tables because we don't have any code in the kernel that does anything like that. So In theory, we could put modules anywhere. We would just have to construct jump tables and a global offset table, and I really don't want to do that.
Couldn't we just make have a single 2 gigabyte region and say those are loaded in there, and we use other regions for everything else?
What I'd like to do is restructure the KVM so that it has a full 512 gigabytes of KVM. Sit the kernel right at the top of address space so that the compiler can still efficiently generate code for it, and just simply load modules above the kernel in what's left of that 2 gigabyte space, and have the pageable space live below the kernel. Problem is, none of our platforms actually have that particular model implemented. The assumption is that the kernel either lives at the top or the bottom and grows in one direction, whereas to do that we'd actually need to do a grow in both directions, and I just haven't sat down and figured out how to make that work. Can we compile the kernel modules with large? Actually, I figured out how to make -fpic kernel modules work, and that theoretically will solve the limitations of reaching across the address space. But that then means that kernel modules on AMD64 have the PIC overhead, where none of the other platforms have that overhead. So I haven't rushed into committing that. Yeah. Problem is, there's no large addressing mode.
Isn't there? I was reading in GCC, there's like small, medium, large.
Okay. Yes. However, if you actually read the GCC stuff, there's one. MC model large not implemented and things like that. It won't generate it. They must have changed GCC. I remember looking at some of the... Basically, after I'd got things running and was trying to figure out how to get kernel modules to work, I went back and had a look at what NetBSD did, and they had stuff that just simply our compiler just totally and utterly threw up on and would not have anything to do with it. So they must have fixed infrastructure on the GCC to make that work. Either that or they do some other magic that I don't know about.
So the question from the channel is, do we have anybody currently working on NUMA support, since the NBC Spark group has some pseudo NUMA type of organization?
Not that I'm aware of. No, I don't know of anybody who's doing any NUMA-style optimization or support.
Have we ever done any measurements, particularly with large machines, on how much the latency increases if you're accessing memory on CPUs that are relatively far away from you?
No. You're digging down into the laundry basket here, and you're finding some very dirty laundry. The dirty secret is there's actually been very little performance testing done. And so things like that, it basically got to the point that it runs and it works and it's stable and so things like the math libraries are functional, and occasionally we find something that doesn't work where I made a mistake in the libraries. There was one that caused the compiler to blow up with CVSUP, for example. CVSUP, that was another adventure in its own right. Something else that I wanted to mention, but I don't remember what it was now.
Module.
Compiler? Modules? No. Look at the notes again. I got nothing. Any more questions? Yeah?
Do you have any work listed on the Patricia's new kernel newbies thing I saw on the previous announcement? The quarterly thing where it's like you can post things for previous kernel newbies.
Are
there any junior kernel hacker tasks?
JKH list.
If somebody wanted to do the Gizrael DT stuff, I'd be happy to help.
use, user LDT.
Yeah, it's it would be an if somebody wanted to work on the user LDT stuff, that would, it's something that needs to be done. It's really nasty.
I thought they didn't have an LDT on the XM.
It's sort of. as I said, it comes under one of those oops sections, but that AMD assumed that people were being a lot nicer than they actually were. The segment types are still there, but they don't actually do anything, and they're only 32 bits wide. So if you do a store into the DS register, the data segment register, nothing happens. CS, DS, and ES are no ops. If you change the segment registers, nothing happens because they're hardwired to zero. If you do a store into FS or GS, right, it will still look up that table, but what happens is that table wasn't expanded because it was assumed that it was never going to be used. And because it wasn't expanded, you can only store 32 bits of data in there. So if you load something into the FS or GS register, right, you can only initialize the first 32 bits of the pointer. And so it can only reference something in the first 2 gigabytes of memory. And what that means is it's fine for 32-bit applications like static binaries or Wine or anything like that, but it's essentially useless for 64-bit applications. So basically, we've got 8 gigabytes of malloc space by default, and nothing, you can't get anything below that address space. So that would be one that is not particularly hard, it's just a bit on the painful side. But the real fun in implementing the LDTs is not the management of the LDTs, but putting it into the context switch routine. That's right, that's what I wanted to mention. Locore.s on i386 is probably somewhere between 500 and a couple thousand lines of assembler code. Locore.s, this is the one that does the startup of the machine, is about 8 lines of assembler code on AMD 64. So it's quite a bit smaller. I was particularly proud that I got it that small.
Mine's counting the
license. Yeah, but of actual assembler instructions, I think it's 8 instructions.
All right,
whatever, 8 to 15, close enough. How many of them are mnemonics versus actual code?
No, that was just counting right down to the non-geometric
V-text. Okay, fair enough. Well, anyway, it's small. And the reason why Locore is so small is because I put the startup code in Loader and changed the Loader handoff protocol. Jeez. And so what happens is...
Jeez. It's all paid in from my EFI work.
So what i386 does when it starts is the Loader sets it up into flat 32-bit mode and jumps to the kernel at the wrong address. And so the kernel is compiled at one address and is being run from another. And so if you read all of Locore.s, there's
I remember it well.
Yes, oh, I remember it well, says Julian. There's a whole series of nasty assembler macros that try to compensate for the fact that it's being executed at the wrong address. And so the C compiler doesn't want to actually deal with any of that, so it's several large chunks of code that are written in assembler because you can't do it in C because of that mismatch between addresses. So what I did was I cheated, and I set, instead of a flat address space for the startup protocol, I changed it so that each of the page table trees all pointed to the same entry. And so one gigabyte of memory was mapped over the entire 256 terabytes of address space. And so what happens is when the kernel begins, we can jump, we load it into the first start at address 1 megabyte or 2 megabytes and go upwards. And then we can jump directly into, Lotus switches into 64-bit mode and then jumps directly into the correct address, which it doesn't matter, it's all the same address. So the memory is mirrored on 1 gigabyte boundaries across the entire 256 terabytes. And so that means that none of the relocation hacks are needed anymore, which means that a good portion of low-code.s that was written in assembler, creating the page table trees, can now be done in C, and is quite a lot simpler. So you can actually recreate page tables, whereas you can't read you can't easily read the low-code.s on i386 that does the same thing.
Couldn't we do the same thing on 386?
We could, but then Bruce would kill me. Because if we did that, we'd be forced to use Loader.
You mean the Bruce debugger wouldn't work anymore?
I think we've thoroughly killed Bruce debugger.
We killed Bruce Loader next.
Well, you see, that's the thing. On i386, you can go from the bootloader, and you can, with quite a considerable amount of pain, directly boot a kernel without using Loader, so straight from the boot to prompt. It's actually quite difficult because our kernel these days depends on hints being compiled and only the loader passes them in. So if you actually want to load a kernel directly from the boot to prompt, you actually have to statically compile in enough hints to get the system up and running. Otherwise it can't find a console or anything useful like that.
Question from the net. Can somebody ask about how interrupts are routed or rooted in AMD 64, round robin around the CPUs, or bind each interrupt to a CPU? Question mark. From Repi, whoever that is. Who is Repi?
It works for Google. I don't know if I should answer that question as a matter of principle, but the answer is the interrupt routing code is exactly the same as it is on i386. Which basically means it's round robin, except when both manufacturers have now broken it. So we don't bind interrupts to CPUs. We receive interrupts on whatever CPU that the hardware sends it to, which up until Pentium 4 meant round robin. On Pentium 4 and Athlon and Opteron and later, that basically means the highest numbered CPU.
Just my own question.
Yeah.
Do you know of any sites that are using AMD64 systems in large scale production? And so, like, what are they doing?
www.yahoo.com has got AMD64 machines in production. There's a whole series of Yahoo is running it on the machines that collect the ad server statistics. So that's direct revenues. So those machines are in our revenue stream. So, not all of them. we're finding hiccups, but we're brave enough to actually run this stuff.
With the new architectures coming out, is there any? Has anyone seen any sanity from the manufacturers in terms of having a cheap to read synchronized across CPUs time source?
That sounds like a whole thing.
Have you heard any rumors of that?
No. Synchronized across CPUs, wouldn't that be nice? Question was, is there any hope of a cheap to read synchronized across CPUs time source from any of the manufacturers from Julian? And the answer is not that I know of. I mean, you have the ACPI timer, but that's not particularly cheap and not particularly accurate, so.
Not particularly synchronized.
Well, there's only one of them, it better be synchronized.
That's what I mean. I mean, two of you can't access it at the same time.
Yes, you can. The ACPI timer is a 32-bit value, so you can just do a read.
Yeah, but I thought that was done through the BIOS, through software to get.
No.
Well, it depends on which accessibility you need, faster or slow. Using slow as a pseudo-bytes, as fast as it's a trick read. It depends on whether the startup code decides whether it's fast or just safe when you're just
reading. Yeah, well, the difference. You can talk about AMD now. Dave O'Brien just fell off the net.
Yeah, Everybody might be listening still, though. So. Just because he's off IRC doesn't mean he's actually gone. Yep.
Could you talk about the syscalls and your performance syscalls in Navi 64?
The what? The
performance
syscalls. Yes. The new form of syscall, the fast syscalls. Basically, what happens on 802.3.8.6 is it's a trap. So it pushes a whole series of registers on the stack and goes from there. Intel added sysenter and sysexit instructions in Pentium Pro, I think it was, and they optimized things to a degree. It eliminated a whole series of pushes onto memory and had a predetermined segment register number to load into the kernel for segments. Even that, though, was still pretty slow. It was involved quite a lot of microcode, so several hundred clock cycles to implement it, to actually do a sysenter instruction, versus about 400 or 500 clock cycles for trap. AMD had done, way back on the K6, they'd done a syscall and sysread instruction independently of what Intel had done, and they did a really mean and lean and close to the bone syscall instruction. That's what's used in the AMD64 ABI, which basically meant that Intel had to implement it. And what it does is it completely bypasses all of the protection checks. You load predetermined values for things into machine-specific registers, and it executes, I think, in 12 clock cycles. So it's order of magnitude or more faster than the other ways of doing it. That makes it really interesting because all that it does is it saves... it works by copying a couple of copying a couple of values from one register into another and gives you no way of saving all of the original registers. So that's another reason why the calling conventions are the way that they are, so that if you make a system call which is guaranteed to trash certain registers, those certain registers happen to be the ones of the scratch registers. So basically what we do is we take that, we enter the kernel, save a couple of values and in the system call wrapper we do actually write them onto the stack because of the way that we do our argument passing to system calls, so we need to be able to pass a pointer to it because of various arcane reasons that's specific to our kernel. So we generate a stack frame that's convenient for the calling convention ABI, which happens to be a little faster than what the i386 ABI does.
That's because of the UAP stuff that's in the system call stuff.
Well, basically what we do is we save only when we enter the kernel for a system call, we only save the registers that we actually have to save that are part of the part of the calling convention for the arguments. So I think we save six out of the 16 registers. We do save extras, I'm sorry. There's another four of the high registers that are not part of the calling convention, we save them as well. But all the scratch registers that are not also arguments, we don't save them. And we just pass a pointer to the system call and they fetch it straight out of memory. Simply because we're sharing common code with all the other platforms, and so it's just the way that the code's written, and we can't use register passing on that particular layer. It'd be nice if we could, but we can't. Not without putting 50 million ifdefs all over the kernel, which case I'd get a lot of email from Bruce. So, it's just basically got a couple of restrictions. Like you must have the registers laid out the protection registers laid out in a certain way, because there's no validation, and you had damn well better get it right, otherwise you end up with user mode running in ring zero and things like that. That's bad.
Well, I think I have one last question. I think probably it's the end of the evening, yeah. Which is if I were to go home with an AMD 64 CD and load it up, are there any traps I should be looking for at this time?
Yeah, there's no really big dragons. I think there's no dragons. There's device and chipset. So there's problems with serial ATA in certain circumstances with large amounts of memory. But that applies to all systems.
I thought that was corrected in 7.0 and it has been MSC or something.
I don't know. Honestly don't know what the state of it is. But if you actually went out and got a 6.0 CD from somewhere, it would probably have problems with that kind of thing. The only things that you're really likely to run into are ACPI problems. In theory, all AMD 64 machines have ACPI. In theory, all AMD 64 machines have an APIC. And that's fine in theory, but then you have people like Gigabyte and Tyan and NVIDIA and everybody who come along and make a really good mess of things. And so there's all sorts of interesting bugs and quirks and BIOS problems that can sabotage an otherwise usable machine.
Well, nobody can find the same thing on
A386. It's the exact same problems. It's the exact same problems, except it's really depressing because this stuff is required to work on the AMD 64 platform by Microsoft. So how they can call this stuff Windows compatible and get away with it, I really don't know.
What about?
What's your preferred platform to run on? What do you develop on this level? Give us the least amount of problems you can.
Macintosh.
Besides the fact that I said that I eat my own dog food, I actually use this stuff. That's my own one and only system. I don't have an i386 machine. Actually, that's not true. That laptop is an i386 machine, but that's a terminal. So, what I actually run on my machines, my desktops, is an old VIA VIA-based motherboard. So I still have socket 754, Athlon 64. Single CPU systems. Plus I have a couple of AMD machines. If you ever heard of the Doghouse, it's a machine that's about this wide and that long and this high, and it's got this big door that opens up on it, very much like a doghouse does, and inside there's full of lots of blinking lights and fans and all sorts of amazing stuff. And it's a quad CPU system, and that's what I do all my SMP development work on. But it's a headless box, so.
Is that?
It's a melody. Yeah.
Okay. Are we done? Okay. I think we're done. I think we should.
Oh, before we. One last thing. One last thing I want to say. This is a confession of sorts. The funniest mistake that I ever made on the port was when I set the still lingering parts of the i386 protection system laying around. And in one of these table structures called the TSS, at one point Intel added on this bitmap of IO ports that you were allowed to access. And one of my favorite bugs that I accidentally made was I set the offset of this table, of the bitmap, to zero instead of setting it to the size of the table, because the table has a fixed size that's specified in the descriptor. And for not having a table, you're supposed to set the pointer to be right at the end, and of course, because there's nothing coming after it, you have no table. But I set it to zero. And so what happened was every time we did an in B or an out B, it would actually interpret the binary contents of the table, which is all the interrupt stack pointers and segment protection radiuses and so on, as a binary ones and zeros for whether you're allowed to do an in B or an out B. And so what that meant was you were able to do in-B, unprivileged user applications were able to do an in-B and out-B to roughly a quarter of the in-B and out-B address space. What that meant was that the Matrox MGA graphics driver for X Windows worked out of the box. It allowed access to enough ports that the Matrox driver would work. And of course, the very first thing that David O'Brien did when he got it was, tell him, the X server, I thought you said this was working. It doesn't work on my ATI or my NVIDIA or anything like that. So I sat down and had a look. That's odd. I forgot to commit the code that open/dev/io to access the graphics card. I wonder why the Matrox card worked. it must have just done an mmap on the MMIO space and must not have been doing any inbeers or outbeers or anything. I never looked at it again. So 6 to 12 months later, it was discovered that you could do inbeers and outbeers, and that was the reason why the Matrox driver worked. So that was my all-time favorite funniest oops. Yep.
Thank you.
We hold the empty whiteboard.
You have to write something on the whiteboard now.
Some pile right.
Yes.